The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next hour I will be reading to you from Time Magazine. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com. That's gsuggsinsurance.com. Or call 919-875-8889. Today's issue of Time Magazine is dated February 14/February 21, 2022. Its cover is bicolor today. It does not have the entire red border with white inner margin as usual. Part of it, approximately the right third, is black, with Time in large block print superimposing that black background in bright white. Now, the other side of the cover, approximately two-thirds, is populated with what look like stars or asterisks or bowling balls with spokes or wheels that are not entirely wheel-like. They all have protrusions around these spheres, and they are the coronavirus virus, and they are in different sizes. They're all bright red, but they're in different sizes, let's say large, medium to small, and very small, which is a spattering against that black background to the right. The first page that I will be reading today is for the record. It's sayings. Let's see, today we have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, as usual. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. Okay. Of course, I am an optimist, and I am pretty sure it will. Now, this is stated by Justice Stephen Breyer, B-R-E-Y-E-R, ruminating on whether the American experiment will survive January 27, while announcing his retirement from the U.S. Supreme Court. "We don't talk about Bruno. No, no, no," stated by Carolina Gaitan, singing the opening lines of Lin-Manuel Miranda's "We Don't Talk About Bruno," which January 31 became the first song from a Disney animated movie to top the Billboard Hot 100 chart in nearly 30 years. "We have seen that the actual use of hen, H-E-N, has increased and stabilized," stated by Daniel Ims, I-M-S, a member of Norway's Language Council, confirming plans for the gender-neutral pronoun hen to officially enter the Norwegian language January 31, joining the masculine han, H-A-N, and feminine hun, H-U-N, 40, the number of Jeopardy games won by Amy Schneider through January 26, a streak that makes her the most successful woman to have competed on the show. There's a very small graphic here of a woman, presumably Amy Schneider, behind the Jeopardy panel or desk or counter, and in front of her is apparently her total winnings, $1,382,800. 2 weeks, the length of suspension handed to The View co-host Whoopi Goldberg February 1, the day after she made widely condemned comments about the Holocaust during a conversation on the daytime talk show. "I have been completely betrayed by the DOJ lawyers," by Wanda Cooper Jones, mother of Armand Arbery, responding to a plea deal announced January 30 to allow two men convicted of her son's murder to avoid trial on federal hate crime charges. A judge later rejected the deal. 477 miles, the length of a single lightning bolt, the longest ever recorded during an April 2020 storm stretching across three states. The World Meteorological Organization confirmed February 1. Now, here's a brief, or rather abstract, I guess it would be, map of the southeastern United States, and I'm going to try and guess which states are affected. They're not labeled, but it appears that this thing is westernmost in East Texas, crosses the southern area of Louisiana, and stops next door, which would be Mississippi, the very southern tip of Mississippi. It felt like a bullet hit to learn that one more precious life died with COVID-19. Stated by Lotay Shering, Prime Minister of Bhutan, in a January 29 Facebook statement responding to the country's fourth recorded coronavirus death. And that person's name is spelled Lotaytshering. That is the Prime Minister of Bhutan. From the news ticker, three short articles on this page. Trump mulled seizing 2020 vote machines. The New York Times reported January 31 that former President Donald Trump directed his lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, to ask the Department of Homeland Security in December 2020 if it could legally take control of voting machines in key swing states amid broader efforts to undermine election results. Holocaust book banned by U.S. school. January 26, McMinn County School Board in Athens, Tennessee, voted unanimously to ban Maus, M-A-U-S, Art Spiegelman's acclaimed graphic novel about his parents' experience in the Holocaust, which depicts Jews as mice and Nazis as cats, over its profanity and naked mice. The Anti-Defamation League has decried the ban. Socialists win big in Portugal elections. Surprising pollsters, Portugal's ruling Socialist Party won an absolute majority of parliamentary seats after a snap election January 30. The outright victory, a rarity for Europe's center-left in recent years, will allow the party to pass an overdue budget and oversee an injection of much-needed EU aid. Rough seas. Now, this is a caption of a photograph. The photo is in the dark. It is at night. The sea is dark. The sky is dark. There looks to be one boat. It actually looks more like a galvanized steel bucket. It has no covering on top of any kind. But next to it on either side are very large inflatable boats, perhaps, or big rafts. They really look like boats because they have the cabin, the enclosed cabin above, if that's what it's called. I apologize if it's not. And these two craft have really bright spotlights atop this cabin or bridge area. There are people climbing all over. Some personnel in white suits, perhaps their official personnel from the boat-looking boats, and then this bucket-looking boat is just full of people. It's just filled with people. Italy's Coast Guard rescues some 280 migrants, mostly Bangladeshis and Egyptians, from a boat attempting to cross from Libya to the Italian island of Lampedusa, January 25. Seven passengers died from hypothermia. While migrant crossings on the route typically peak in summer, more are attempting the treacherous winter journey to Europe this year, with 3,035 arriving in Italy in January, nearly triple the number for the same month in 2020 and 2021. The Bulletin, red states push abortion bans ahead of Supreme Court. This is by Abigail Abrams. As the Supreme Court weighs a high-profile case that could unwind Roe v. Wade, lawmakers across the U.S. are introducing a wave of new bills limiting abortion at the state level. While several states have already introduced bills mimicking Texas' controversial ban on abortion after 6 weeks, at least three more, Florida, Arizona, and West Virginia, are considering bills similar to Mississippi's 15-week abortion ban, the law at the center of the Supreme Court case. State legislatures consider lots of bills aimed at curtailing abortion every year, but GOP lawmakers introducing 15-week bans this term say they are doing so specifically in light of the pending Supreme Court decision. The bills directly violate the so-called viability standard set by Roe v. Wade, which states that women have the constitutional right to end pregnancies until the fetus is viable. Their proponents are betting the Supreme Court's ruling, which is expected before the end of June, will allow Mississippi's ban to stand. Supporters of a 15-week ban argue it strikes a balance between more extreme measures, like the Texas law, and the status quo, in which most states allow abortions until viability, or about 24 weeks. Abortion rights advocates say the 15-week bills are no compromise. They cut access and open the door to further bans. Their goal is to eliminate access to abortion entirely, says Julie Rickelman, litigation director at the Center for Reproductive Rights. These bans would reshape abortion access across the South, and particularly in rural, low-income communities. Many people who want an abortion already must delay it to raise money, take time off work, and arrange child care or transportation. If a state bans abortion after 15 weeks, many would have to travel elsewhere, potentially overwhelming facilities in nearby states. The more states control access to abortion, the harder it becomes for people in the entire region to access it, Rickelman says. More news ticker, three more short items. Military junta ousts Burkina Faso president. Burkina Faso's military overthrew President Roch Kabore, that's R-O-C-H-K-A-B-O-R-E, January 24, replacing him with Lieutenant Colonel Paul-Henri Damiba. Kabore had faced mounting anger over his failure to contain Islamist militants in the country. Burkina Faso is the third West African nation to suffer a coup in the past year after Mali and Guinea. Moderna begins HIV vaccine trial. The biotechnology company Moderna announced January 27 that it had begun a clinical trial of an experimental HIV vaccine using the mRNA technology that also created the company's COVID-19 vaccine. The first participants in phase one of the trial have been vaccinated, the company said. Flurry of new North Korean missile tests. January 30, North Korea conducted its longest-range missile test since 2017, the seventh launched in January alone. Analysts say the test of an intermediate-range missile capable of reaching the U.S. territory of Guam is part of a bid to pressure President Biden into restarting Trump-era talks on sanctions relief. Good question within the brief news. Why is Paris uncovering a river it buried a century ago? In 1899, a writer for the French newspaper Le Figaro surveyed the damage Parisians had done to the Bièvre. For centuries, the 13-foot-wide river had snaked up through southern Paris, joining the Seine in the city center. But as the Industrial Revolution took off, tanneries and dyers had severely polluted its waters. It flows slowly, oily, and black, the writer noted, streaked with acids, dotted with soapy and putrid pustules. Authorities opted to close the river, sealing up the last section in 1912. Its waters no longer even run under Paris, having been cut off at towns closer to its source, 13 miles southwest of the city. Today, though, the Bièvre has an unlikely ally, climate change. The same industrial activity that destroyed the river has helped drive global warming, with Paris's average temperature already 4.1 degrees Fahrenheit, 2.3 degrees centigrade, higher than in the pre-industrial era. The urban heat island effect, in which buildings and pavements absorb more heat than vegetation and water do, is making matters worse, driving Paris's temperature up by as much as 14.4 degrees Fahrenheit, 8 degrees centigrade, more than nearby rural areas during heat waves. By the mid-21st century, according to local government estimates, Paris could have a climate resembling that of Seville in southern Spain. We have to adapt Paris to the future, and yet this is one of the most densely populated cities in the world, with lots of heritage restrictions, so we are limited in what we can do, says Dan Lert, L-E-R-T, Paris's deputy mayor for climate, water, and energy. La Bièvre is one of the great tools that we have. Bodies of water help to cool the surrounding areas because as water particles absorb heat from the air and then evaporate, they carry the heat away with them, lowering the ground level temperature. They can also mitigate floods by giving excess rainwater somewhere to go and make cities a more pleasant place to live. With that in mind, Mayor Anne Hidalgo agreed to a proposal for the rebirth of the Bièvre by Paris's Green Party as part of a 2021 coalition deal. A feasibility study is underway, and Lair expects to complete the first Parisian section by 2026 at a cost of around $16 million. It will join several stretches of the Bièvre recently uncovered in smaller towns to the south, including the suburb of Archeuil, which will open a section in spring 2022. At that point, the Bièvre's waters will begin running through pipes under Paris to reach the Seine again. The Bièvre isn't the only urban river to get a new chance at life in the climate change era. Last May, Manchester in the UK uncovered a downtown section of the River Medlock, which it had buried 50 years ago, and authorities in New York City are studying a $130 million plan to reopen the Bronx's Tibbetts Brook to reduce flood risks. The trend represents a reversal among urban leaders who once saw limiting nature's footprint as crucial to development, says Snigdha Garg, head of adaptation research at the Climate Leadership Group C40. We are seeing that it's moving away from nature. Whether that's the true course of a river or where trees should be, that is causing many of our problems, Garg said. And now, gradually, cities are learning to live with nature. That article was written by Ciara Nugent. Beneath the Nation headline, an immigration quagmire mires Afghan refugees. This is written by Jasmine Aguilera. And it does show a photograph of 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 individuals, men and women, adults and children, although I see only one adult male. And these people are seated in what looks like a waiting area. Two of the women are wearing headscarves. The adults all wear masks, but not the children. There are bags, like shopping bags from Target or someplace, sitting on the floor amongst the people. Three are seated, the male, adult, and three children. Excuse me, one child is standing, and the two smaller children are being held by adults. Okay, the caption reads, Afghan refugees Afghan refugees wait to be processed at a repatriation center in Van, Turkey, September 28. Ahmad Naeem Wakili escaped Afghanistan in mid-August after the government collapsed and the Taliban took Kabul. A former judge who had earned the Taliban's ire, Wakili was granted refuge in the U.S. by the American government under an ad hoc program called humanitarian parole. Wakili now lives in Tucson, Arizona, where he dreams of reuniting with his family who remain in Turkey. But over the past few months, U.S. immigration officials have twice rejected his wife and two-year-old daughter's humanitarian parole applications, although the rejection letters cite a problem with the fees that Wakili attempted to pay, a total of $1,150, U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services, USCIS, provided him with no further explanation. Wakili's story's not unique. His family are among tens of thousands of Afghan nationals marooned in immigration bureaucracy amid programs that are understaffed, underfunded, and simply ill-equipped to serve Afghans in need. Their struggle illustrates the broader systemic failures of the U.S. immigration system. This particular dilemma arose last summer when top officials at the White House and the Department of Homeland Security, DHS, searching for ways to help Afghan nationals seeking refuge in the U.S., decided to direct them to apply for humanitarian parole. The idea was that this little-used pathway would help avoid the months-long wait times typical of more traditional channels like the U.S. Refugee Admissions Program, USRAP, which was gutted by former President Trump. The Biden administration inherited a very broken, under-resourced, overburdened, and overcomplicated program, and humanitarian parole was the easy way out, says Mark Hetfield, president and CEO of HIAS, formerly the Hebrew Immigration Aid Society, a refugee resettlement agency. But if the decision to direct Afghans to humanitarian parole was made with good intentions, it's become precisely the bureaucratic quagmire officials hope to avoid. In the months after the U.S. military pulled out of Afghanistan, humanitarian parole applications soared. In a typical year, USCIS receives fewer than 2,000 humanitarian parole applications and approves from 500 to 700. Since July 2021, the agency has received more than 40,000 applications. The vast majority of these applications have yet to be fully processed. As of January 12, the agency had conditionally approved roughly 145 and rejected 560 per the USCIS. Researchers and advocates question why Biden officials decided to direct Afghans toward humanitarian parole rather than directing resources back into USRAP. It is bizarre to me that the Biden administration didn't use the Afghan evacuation as an opportunity to kick the refugee resettlement program into gear, says Yael Shocker, Deputy Director for the Americas and Europe at Refugees International, a refugee advocacy organization. Unlike refugee status, humanitarian parole does not confer immediate work authorization, access to health care, or a path to permanent residency, nor does it facilitate the family reunification process. Also, because humanitarian parole is determined on an ad hoc basis, it often is not clear what is required for an application to be approved. Humanitarian parole is not intended to replace established refugee processing channels, a USCIS spokesperson says. Neither DHS nor the State Department would comment on the humanitarian parole program. Meanwhile, Wakili says he feels numb. I don't care if they don't give me asylum, he says, but I need my family here. More news tickers here, another three. Amnesty accuses Israel of apartheid. The latest human rights group to characterize Israel's treatment of Palestinians as apartheid. Amnesty International highlighted unlawful killings, land seizures, and the denial of nationality and citizenship in a damning February 1 report, prompting backlash from Israeli officials. California moves to dismantle death row. In the next 2 years, California plans to transfer all current prisoners on its death row to other prisons. The Associated Press reported January 31 in a move toward closing the largest death row in the U.S. The news comes 3 years after Governor Gavin Newsom placed a moratorium on executions. Peru oil spill, an ecological disaster. Tsunami waves caused by the January 15 eruption of a Tongan volcano led nearly 12,000 barrels of oil to leak from into the ocean, twice as much as previously thought, Peruvian officials said January 27. They called the spill an ecological disaster and have banned 4 employees of oil company Repsol from leaving the country. Sports. What happens if an athlete tests positive for COVID-19 at the Beijing Olympics? This is by Alice Park. Becoming an Olympian is a long and unpredictable journey rife with hurdles. But those in Beijing for the 2022 Winter Games face yet another daunting challenge, COVID-19. Hanging over every athlete is the specter of testing positive, beginning with a deep nasopharyngeal swab at the airport. All athletes are required to be vaccinated or receive a medical exemption and comply with a 21-day quarantine if they are not. Still, with the Omicron variant so widespread and adept at sparking new infections, breakthrough infections are possible, even among the vaccinated. Beijing officials have created a closed-loop system to adhere to the Chinese government's dynamic zero-COVID policy, which relies on regular testing to detect infections and rigid isolation requirements to prevent spread of cases. But testing positive is not athletes' only worry. They could also be considered a close contact of someone with a positive test. Athletes identified as a close contact can continue to compete, but must take extra steps for 14 days, wear a mask, quarantine in a single room, arrange for dedicated Olympic vehicles in which they are the only passenger, eat alone, either in the room or at a separate table in dining facilities, and avoid interacting with others. Most important, they cannot train indoors, and their National Olympic Federation must make arrangements to set up separate training facilities and times. How the creator of Wordle really feels about selling his addictive game. This is by Carl Vick. It will probably be abridged. Wordle is spelled W-O-R-D-L-E. There's a graphic here at the beginning of this article. It contains 30 squares in a grid pattern. And it's probably the title of the article because it says viral. This is from left to right, top to bottom. Words craze earns major money. A couple of hours after the New York Times announced January 31, it had acquired the online word game known as Wordle. Its inventor was still looking for the right word, this time for his emotions. My biggest sense, actually, right now isn't joy, it's relief. Josh Wardle, W-A-R-D-L-E, who was paid a reported low 7 figures for the daily puzzle, told me. It was our second conversation in as many days. The day before, he had betrayed no hint of an impending windfall. In fact, much of the conversation was about how Wordle, a simple game that gives a player six chances to guess a five-letter word, demonstrated that the Internet could be about something other than money. "I made something," he explains, "that I would like to exist on the Internet. Other people liked it, too." November 1, 2021, 90 people played Wordle. By the end of December, there were 300,000 players a day. During the month of January, the number swelled beyond 10 million, the kind of acceleration that creates its own weather. The opening sketch of the January 22 Saturday Night Live featured an impersonation of President Donald Trump, former President Donald Trump, playing Wordle. But when we met, Wordle had not wanted his photo taken and was clearly worn down by the attention tsunami, which a few days earlier had even swept across the Great Plains to engulf a Canadian equipment salesman also named Josh Wordle. "I think if I was actually the creator," the other Wordle observed to one reporter, "I'd be quite exhausted." This Wordle was. "My inbox is destroyed," Wordle says slowly. He grew up on an organic farm in Wales, came to the States for an MFA in digital art, then found jobs in Silicon Valley. Working at Reddit, he created a couple of projects that doubled as case studies in a question that lately preoccupies much of the world. How does the design of a site steer the behavior of the people coming to it? Wordle provides one answer. It was fashioned for an audience of one, his partner, Palak Shah, who likes word games. It went out onto the larger world almost as a whim, without any of the things that could generate money. No ads or push notifications. You can play only once a day, and that play benefits only you. Far from producing income, the game, at least till January 31, was actually costing Wordle roughly $100 a month to keep it online. He seemed fine with that. And that seemed the most interesting aspect of what he was doing. "That was never the goal, really, to make money," he said. "The goal was to make a game that my partner would enjoy playing. What is interesting is people ask me all the time about the monetization stuff, like you could put ads on it, you could do premium. And I don't know, maybe I'm an idiot. None of that really appeals to me. I think because I started with the intention of not doing it, it's been easy to say no. If I'd been trying to make a viral game, I think it would be very different." Games like that are all over the web, now thick with knockoffs. Wordle has existed in a different space, one generated by the delight of the people playing it. And for a game played by one person, it has encouraged a fair amount of community, which is the part Wordle says has moved him. It was a player in New Zealand who came up with a way of sharing how well you did without revealing the target word. Wordle thanked her, turned it into a bit of code, and passed it on. And that article was abridged. Now here's the brief news, Q&A. Dr. Francis Collins looks back on 13 years at the NIH. This is by Belinda Luscombe. Before he stepped down December 19, Dr. Francis Collins was the longest serving director of the National Institutes of Health since presidents began to appoint them. He is that rare bureaucrat who is also a career scientist, and the rare scientist who is a devout Christian. He spoke with Time about what is next for the country's public health efforts. Time. Polls suggest that a majority of Americans believe that the information coming from public health officials is confusing. Why do you think it's been a mess? Collins, the most significant reason is that the science is changing. You would not complain to your stockbrokers if they gave you a different recommendation about a stock from 2 weeks ago. You'd say, oh, this person's really on top of what's happening. But I will say there have been instances where the communication has not been ideal. Question. Indeed, you have drawn a lot of criticism with major media outlets saying you shut down debate and censored approaches other than the official one. How do you respond? Answer, I will not apologize for saying a dangerous public health proposal needs to be addressed. Maybe I could have used a better word than taken down or whatever in my emails. I was not expecting that they would become a topic of Senator Rand Paul's latest hearing. It was my job as the leader of the world's largest supporter of biomedical research to call terrible ideas out. Question, what has been your darkest hour? Answer, the resistance of more than 50 million Americans to take advantage of life-saving, safe, and effective vaccines. Estimates are more than 100,000 people have died because of misinformation. That's about as dark as it gets. Question, many of the people who distrust the vaccine also call themselves Christians. Why do you think that is? Answer, I identify as a white evangelical Christian, and that is the very group where the vaccine hesitancy is highest. I do not want to blame any of those people who have been somehow seduced by misinformation into a position that is not good for them. I blame the people who are spreading the misinformation, especially those who know it is not true and are doing so anyway. Question. Who's that? Do you think Rand Paul knows it's not true? Answer. Good question. Does Rand Paul know that what he's spreading around, while it might be good for his political career and fundraising, is actually untrue? People are pretty good, I guess, at fooling themselves. I do think elected public officials have a responsibility when they are putting out information to know whether it's true or not. You almost feel like political parties want public health efforts to fail if they're being produced by their enemies. Question. A lot of science graduates are going into tech or finance because it's more lucrative. Are you worried about a brain drain from medicine? Answer, I'm not worried so far. I think it should be clear to people that biomedical research is on an incredibly steep exponential curve of discovery and application. This is the best time in the history of the planet to be part of this adventure. Milestones died, and I'm going to have to spell this name, T-H-I-C-H. N-H-A-T-H-A-N-H. I'm quite sure that the last two words in that name are not Han. And this is by Father Richard Rohr, R-O-H-R, who's a Franciscan friar, teacher, author, and founder of the Center for Action and Contemplation. Buddhist monk, and the name, again, T-H-I-C-H, not Han, died January 22 at 95 and exemplified simplicity and humility. He was one of the first people who helped me grapple with what mindfulness really meant. Many teachers try to focus on letting go of the mind. That is such a daunting concept, but he emphasized mindfulness. These teachings had so many simple yet profound implications. They were not highly philosophical or abstract, rather, grounded in reality. One of Not Han's most memorable sayings was his prediction that the next Buddha might not be an individual, but a community. I agree with him. We are not looking for individual messiahs anymore. We need concrete gatherings of people who can sustain loving, nonviolent relationships over time. That combination of individual as well as community-oriented enlightenment is his greatest gift. Two more people died here. Chesley Christ, K-R-Y-S-T, the 2019 Miss USA, January 30 at 30. Olavo de Carvalho, a mentor of Brazil's Jair Bolsonaro, on January 24 at 74. Renamed the Washington Commanders, February 2, 18 months after the NFL team retired its previous name because of its insensitivity to Native Americans. Continuing with milestones, died Thierry Mugler, and I apologize if I'm mispronouncing that. The first name is spelled T-H-I-E-R-R-Y, the last name M-U-G-L-E-R. Fashion Visionary by John Epperson, who is an actor, writer, musician, and drag artist. Terry Mugler had that fire. He had the passion, not only the big vision, but also the meticulousness needed to design clothes well, down to what exactly a curve should look like and how it should be executed. I first met Mugler, who died at 73, January 23, in 1989 when he discovered my off-Broadway show. I performed as my uber-glam female character, Lipsinka. He hired me to jump out of a cake at his birthday party. He later said he wanted me to be part of his spring-summer 1992 runway show at Paris Fashion Week. This was something I had long dreamed of, to be in a Parisian fashion show wearing women's clothes. "We realize your body type is not the same as one of our fitting models," he told me as the show was approaching. Well, duh, I am a man. So I went to Paris 2 weeks before the show, just for fittings. That was pretty glamorous. It was my funny face moment. My performance involved me peeling away layers of my look as I lip-synced and posed and literally crawled down the catwalk from a parody of Dior's 1950s new look in black to a sequined cowgirl meets showgirl costume to what I called a Russ Meyer baby doll gown. It gave the seen it all crowd something to cheer about. Mugler had a great sense of humor and an irreverence about fashion. He liked to see European and American pop sensibilities collide with couture. Looking back, I think we were provocateurs who saw the runway as a place for surrealist theater, and that is what Mugler continued to create, beautifully, until he chose to stop. Retired Tom Brady, NFL legend, by Sean Gregory. When an NFL player decides to retire at 44, it rarely comes as a surprise, but Tom Brady thought he could throw touchdown passes forever. "I really think I can play as long as I want," Brady told reporters last October. Fans had plenty of reasons to believe him. Brady played in 3 Super Bowls past the age of 40, 10 in total, 7 of which his team won. And although his Tampa Bay Buccaneers, the defending Super Bowl champions, lost to the Los Angeles Rams in the playoffs, he was also coming off a career year. But after days of speculation, Brady confirmed his plan to step back from his competitive commitment to football in a February 1 statement. The all-time bar for NFL greatness that Brady has set is made even more remarkable by his low-round draft choice. He was taken in the 6th round and 199th overall in the 2000 NFL draft. Drew Bledsoe was supposed to be the franchise quarterback in New England. Bledsoe got hurt, and Brady made history. So yes, Brady's retirement is surprising, but it shouldn't be shocking. Every quarterback from now on will be chasing Brady. He has earned the right to protect his health and spend more time with his family. 7 Super Bowl rings will have to do. And here's one final little banner column with milestones reported. Warned the U.S. State Department of potential missile or drone attacks in the UAE January 27 due to the threats from Yemeni rebels in the region. Resigned CNN President Jeff Zucker February 2 over a previously undisclosed consensual relationship with a colleague. Stepped down Brian Houston, leader of Hillsong Leader, January 30, amid allegations which he denies that he concealed his father's child abuse. Reported bomb threats at more than a dozen historically black colleges and universities, which the FBI said February 2 it is investigating as possible hate crimes. Sworn in Xiomara Castro as Honduras's first female president, January 27, and the person's first name is spelled Xiomara, last name Castro, and adopted, and here's a small, very small photo of a very pretty little gray-brown cat, Willow, a 2-year-old tabby, by the Biden family, the White House announced January 28. The Brief Nation features politics, and beneath that, the anti-vax movement is taking over the right, by Vera Bergengruen, Washington. Lee Haywood got the COVID-19 vaccine. He has seen friends lose their lives to the virus and watched others struggle to recover. A longtime smoker, he believes the medical evidence showing the shot sharply reduces the chances of a severe infection. Yet, on the frigid afternoon of January 23, Haywood was near the steps of the Lincoln Memorial in Washington, standing among signs that read, "Vaccines kill," and "Stop the Vaccine Holocaust." "I am against the forced vaccinations or forced wearing of these masks by these bureaucrats deep in the bowels of government," says Haywood, a 61-year-old Republican running for a North Carolina congressional seat. "These mandates just slap everybody in the face." Haywood's presence at the Defeat the Mandates rally illustrated how the anti-vaccine movement is uniting groups across the right. Once a fringe cohort, it's repositioned itself as an opponent of mandates and government overreach. The distinction has attracted legions of new supporters by tapping into the anger, exhaustion, and frustration of millions of Americans as the pandemic drags on. At the D.C. demonstration, right-wing conspiracy theorists and vaccine skeptics mingled with libertarians, critics of Big Pharma, conservative politicians like Haywood. Clusters of teachers and nurses stood alongside firefighters and church groups, the yellow Gadsden flags adopted by the Tea Party more than a decade ago, mixed with Trump 2020 placards and Stop the Steal signs. Men wearing the insignia of the far right Proud Boys lingered on the edges of the crowd near a group of women wearing flower crowns and snapping selfies with a "Mama Bears Against Mandates" board. For this motley cross-section of the right, the issues become a defining marker of political identity. "There's no going back now," says Addie Johnson, 43, who drove in from Virginia, and says she has lost friends and family relationships in the past year over her anti-vaccination stance. "You're either with this movement or against it." The coordination in the days before the rally illustrated the reach of the anti-mandate message. The event was promoted on Joe Rogan's podcast, the most popular show on Spotify, as well as on former Trump advisor Steve Bannon's War Room podcast. Calls between organizers and attendees on the social audio app Clubhouse often stretched on several hours. Supporters shared information on Facebook and Telegram, offered to pay for one another's bus tickets to Washington, and swapped advice on which restaurants and hotels would not require proof of vaccination. The growing U.S. anti-vaccine movement is part of a global effort. The Washington rally featured speakers from Israel and the U.K., who frequently referenced lockdown measures abroad. Photos and videos of the event were widely shared in large international anti-vaccine and far-right Telegram groups. The D.C. demonstration was scheduled to coincide with global anti-vaccine protests organized by a far-right German group under the banner Worldwide Rally for Freedom. It was a reflection of how the opposition to mandates, like other right-wing movements, has crossed borders in recent years. On stage, a host of anti-vaccine celebrities, from Robert F. Kennedy Jr. to right-wing doctors promoting alternative COVID-19 treatments, compared U.S. vaccination policies to Nazi Germany and the Soviet Union. Physicians in white coats falsely claimed vaccines are not working. The overarching goal is to create a populist movement through the propagation of disinformation and to undermine well-respected American institutions, says Nick Sawyer, an emergency room physician who runs the group No License for Disinformation, which advocates for state medical boards to revoke the licenses of doctors who spread disinformation. and prescribe unproven treatments. This anti-science, anti-government movement is taking advantage of a fringe group of doctors' medical credentials to amplify and legitimize a harmful agenda, Sawyer says. The shadow of the January 6, 2021 protest, which culminated in the attack on the U.S. Capitol by a mob of Trump supporters, lingered over the Defeat the Mandates rally. Unfortunately, many people who wanted to come were scared to join because of it being so close to January 6, says Caitlin Durston, who organized a bus to Washington from Pennsylvania, filled with nearly 50 people from a conservative parents group. Rally organizers cast the event in the tradition of the civil rights movement, complete with peace signs and tambourines. Yet experts warn that the growth of the joint anti-vaccine and anti-mandate movements could also provide cover to darker forces. In the context of the Capitol riot and the rising number of threats leveled against public officials nationwide, the calls to action at the Defeat the Mandates rally included some disturbing warning notes. Some of the speakers at the rally threatened the press. Others inveighed against Dr. Anthony Fauci, President Joe Biden's chief medical advisor, invoking the Nuremberg trials of leading Nazis. Leaning against a tree, a woman in a pink headband and sunglasses held a sign declaring in bold black and red letters, "Shoot those who try to kidnap and vaccinate your child." Organizers are trying to funnel the movement's growing number of adherents toward the political process. They directed supporters to contact their members of Congress and local government officials. Each of the 36 rally-goers who spoke to Time said the issue would be their top priority when they next go to the polls. Already, opposition to vaccine and mask mandates has become a purity test for Republican officials. Just 26% of Republicans say they consider vaccine mandates acceptable, according to a poll conducted by CNN in December, compared with 82% of Democrats. This partisan divide is evident in the vaccination data itself. Unvaccinated adults are 3 times more likely to lean Republican than Democrat, according to an analysis last November by the Kaiser Family Foundation. Last summer, nearly half of House Republicans refused to say whether they'd been vaccinated when asked by CNN. In Georgia, neither of the Republican frontrunners for the U.S. Senate nomination will say whether they received the vaccine. In January, a GOP city council member in New York City refused to disclose her vaccination status, even though doing so barred her from entering the chamber. The opposition to mask and vaccine mandates has become so powerful with many Republicans that some of the rally-goers expressed frustration toward Trump, who has acknowledged receiving his COVID-19 booster. The movement's us versus them language has the potential to make it a powerful political force, says Renee DiResta, who leads research on anti-vaccine disinformation at the Stanford Internet Observatory. DiResta predicts a push to sink candidates who do not malign vaccine mandates in upcoming GOP primaries. "That's the strategy I think we will see in 2022, she says. Meanwhile, by uniting under an anti-mandate umbrella, those who are anti-vaccine or espouse extremist views may be able to evade moderation by social media platforms," DiResta says. The vaccines are tyrannical government overreach argument is still a permissible one that can be made because social media companies do not want to look like they're putting their thumb on the scale of a political issue. Haywood, the Republican candidate for the U.S. House of Representatives from North Carolina, says standing up against vaccine mandates will be a key part of his campaign platform. "It's about taking a stand against the government," he says. "They need to be routed out and brought to justice." There's a photo here of a crowd of people. They're just shoulder to shoulder and elbow to elbow on the ground, in outside. There's a pale blue-gray-white sky behind them and bare trees encircling the back of the crowd. All are dressed in winter attire. That is all that I can see. They have on medium to heavy jackets, and a lot are wearing knitted stocking caps, and some are wearing gloves and colorful scarves around their necks. Some have buttons that say Black Lives Matter. Others have other buttons whose writing I cannot read from this distance. A couple of American flags are shown towering over the people, handheld by someone in the crowd. And the caption reads, "Attendees listen to speakers during the January 23 Defeat the Mandates rally." I see lots of senior citizens in this crowd. Some people I would consider middle-aged. Of course, I see only the first, half-dozen rows. The crowd extends beyond the camera's lens. And only a few younger people in the front rows. There's a photo here with a caption that I will read to round out the hour. It's a really dark photo. I guess there are people in the foreground and background, but I can't see them because of the darkness. But front and center is a large silvery trophy cup. It says, "Comeback Champ. Spanish tennis star Rafael Nadal reacts after smashing records January 30 as he beat Russia's Daniil Medvedev in the final of the Australian Open, his 21st Grand Slam singles title." We have run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I am Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com or call 919-875-8889. Time Magazine's available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.